Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. Through two trials, America watched as Juan Martinez fought relentlessly to convict Jody Arias of murder one for viciously stabbing her ex-boyfriend, Travis Alexander, to death. What emerged was a story wrought with sex, manipulation, and deceit that stunned the public at every turn. Arias, always playing the wronged and innocent woman, changed her story continually as her bizarre behavior surrounding the crime and its aftermath came to light. Unwavering, Arias and her defense team continued to play off the salacious details of the case until she was finally found guilty and controversially sentenced to life behind bars. Now speaking openly for the first time, Prosecutor Juan Martinez will unearth new details from the investigation that were never revealed at trial, exploring key facts from the case and the pieces of evidence he chose to keep close to the vest. Throughout the trials, his bullish and unfaltering prosecution strategy was both commended and criticized. And in his book, Martinez will illuminate the unique tactics he utilized in this case and how they led to a successful conviction. And for the first time, discuss how he felt about losing the death penalty sentence he'd pursued for years. Going beyond the news reports, Martinez will explore the truth behind the multiple facades of Jody Arias. Sparring with her from across the stand, Martinez came to know Arias like no one else could, dissecting what it took for a seemingly normal girl to become a deluded, cunning, and unrepentant murderer. This book is the definitive account of the case that shocked America. The book that we're featuring this evening is Conviction, the untold story of putting Jody Arias behind bars, with my special guest, prosecutor and author Juan Martinez. Welcome to the program, and thank you for agreeing to this interview, Juan Martinez.
Well, it's good to be here. Thank you for having me here so that we could talk about the book.
Thank you very much, and I apologize for stumbling through that intro. Before we start, let's have a little bit of a background on your career as a prosecutor in Arizona. And just in that brief introduction, you can tell us a little bit about the office that you do work in and the community that you do serve. So if you could tell us a little bit about your background, please.
Sure. I work for the Maricopa County Attorney's Office, and I started with the Maricopa County Attorney's Office back in October of 1988. This is the agency in Maricopa County that is charged, there's other agencies, but primarily charged with dealing with the felonies felonious sort of actions that take place in Maricopa County. I started there, as I said, in 1988, and for the first 8 years I did not so much lower grade felonies, but not murder. I would say that I did kidnappings, armed robberies, that sort of thing. And I continued on in 1996 when I was moved to what we called back then what is now known as the Capital Litigation Bureau, was the Homicide Bureau. And since October of 1996, that is the place that I have called home. So since then, I've been doing the sort of the high-profile kind of murder cases, and now specifically I do mostly, but only really restricted to the capital prosecutions where the state is seeking the imposition of the death penalty.
Right. Now, how it please tell us the sort of, I guess, quite ordinary way that you were assigned to this case. Tell us that procedure, how you came to take or be assigned to this case, the Jodi Arias murder trial.
Back then, the group had every attorney was assigned to an on-call day or maybe a weekend. And on that particular day, I was assigned on call from June 9 at 8 o'clock in the morning to June 10th at, 8 o'clock in the morning to 8 o'clock the next morning. And what happened in this case is the police called on June 10 at 8:30 in the morning. And by that time, my shift was over. I actually was at the office getting ready to do other things because it was past 8 o'clock, and when I received the call from the sergeant at the Mesa Police Department. And when he called, he said, well, we have this thing out here in East Mesa, and he kind of realized that my my on-call duties were over, and he was sort of apologetic and said, well, you know, if you want, I will go ahead and call the next person on the list. And I thought, well, no. I mean, he had told me that the police had been there the night before, and that's when they discovered the body. And it was really just 30 minutes past the time that my my duties were over. So I just thought, well, in fairness, I should get out there and take a look at what's there rather than turning to the next person that was on the list. So I guess it was just a situation where I didn't want to slough off the work to somebody else.
Now, as you point out in the book, and it's fascinating, the information that you get because of your unique perspective as a prosecutor, and like I'll say to the audience, and probably everybody that's a real true crime fan knows that this does not happen very often. I mean, there has been, obviously, there's Marsha Clark and Helter Skelter, and there's a few books. But so with that, not everybody knows that the involvement that the prosecution, you as a prosecutor, is involved with the crime initially. So that's why you're there involved in going to the crime scene. But tell us the relationship and how it is separate. Obviously, you're there at that time at the crime scene, but you're not per se involved with the investigation. So tell us how that actually works.
The police department called me, and as they would with any other killing, and I remember when I got there that it was already getting hot, and so I remember standing outside because as a person who is not a member of the Mesa Police Department, I'm not allowed to go in until they've secured the scene, they've taken a look at things, and done whatever it is they need to do. And so I waited approximately 30 minutes to go inside. As you pointed out, my role in going inside is just to observe so that whenever the person who committed the killing is apprehended, I will have a better understanding of the facts involved in this case, and specifically the crime scene. So when I'm there, my role is just to look around, take a look at what's there. For example, in this case, it was a two-story house, whether or not it had an east-west, it faced east-west, things like that, or you know, where the body was found. In this case, it was the shower, and just generally look at the layout. And I remember specifically in this case that I was struck by the cleanliness of the home. Usually, when there has been a murder, there's furniture that's in disarray, knocked over, right, pushed about. Not in this case. In the bottom, there was it was very clean. The only thing that I remember being out of place was a dry vacuum cleaner, a wet vacuum cleaner. I had obviously been cleaning the tile downstairs, and the downstairs actually belied what was upstairs. And so walked through the bottom, then went upstairs, and when I went upstairs, that's when I walked through the walk-through closet from the master bedroom into the bathroom where really you could see everything that had happened. But my role there was not to advise the police and tell them do this or do that. It was just to take a look and see what was there so that I wouldn't just have to rely on pictures, and it would make my presentation that much more effective at trial.
Now tell us, you talk about a detective Flores, and of course he is a very important figure in this. So as you explained that your job is just to sort of get a feel for the place, but also tell us, it was very interesting to me to learn, again, how does the relationship progress? The police do the investigation, but it's not like you are not in contact with the police. So tell us, please explain that relationship of what you do with the information that the investigators gather. What do you do with that information?
The Mesa Police Department, in this case, assigned Detective Esteban Flores to be the what is called the case agent. And as a case agent, he is in charge of sort of being the person that's the individual that if there are any questions that need to be directed, any assignments that need to be taken care of, he's the person that does that. And part of his duties include keeping me in the loop or informing me of any new developments that they may have in the case. And so even though, as I said before, I don't direct the investigation, he would call me with updates, and he would let me know how far the investigation had progressed, what was going on, so that when there came a time when I believed, and at that point it would be my judgment, when I believed that a charge was appropriate, I would already have, if you will, all of this background to it, because he'd been filling me in as he went along, and he would submit the case, and at that point I would decide what charge to bring forth. In this case, based on everything that I saw and everything that was presented, I decided to file the charge of first-degree murder.
One other thing that I thought was interesting is that you stressed that you alone prosecute these cases, unlike other people that would have an assistant, and it is a big workload that you embark upon as well. So tell us why this is important to you, that you prosecute alone.
Well, I would say probably because I'm not easy to get along with. It probably would be the first thing that I would say. But no, the reason that I do it is that it just makes me feel more comfortable, because if I'm the only one that's prosecuting this, if I'm the only one with the case, then I am entrusted or have the duty to make sure that I review every bit of evidence that comes in. And the benefit to me of that is that I can take something that perhaps is designated or applies to something else and take a look at it and then pull it in and say, well, wait a minute, it actually applies to this other thing. So it makes me, I think, a bit more prepared, although I will say that that requires a lot of work. I mean, I know that there were many, many weekends that I missed, and that I'm not sure where I'm going to get those back, but there were many, many weekends that I missed because I was reading the documents in this case. This was the most document-intensive case that I've ever dealt with. And so that way, when I go in, I know everything that's been presented to me. I know everything that's gone out to the defense. So, for example, when it comes down to making either an argument to the court or cross-examining somebody, I will know what's in the file. I mean, that's not to say that for other people that the other approach doesn't work. But for me, maybe perhaps I'm a bit of a, person who wants to be in control of the case. And there, I guess, you know, there has to be one general, and I guess that would be me, or one chief, and I guess that would be me.
Sure. Now, you talked about that you went to Mesa, Arizona, and to Travis Alexander's home. He had a nice home, and he rented it out to a couple other people. But when you were in there, you spoke with Detective Flores. And one of the things that he had is that they discovered, well, everyone that's followed this case knows, they found a camera in the washing machine. Can you tell us about that conversation and how important
Initially when we did the walkthrough, the main focus of the walkthrough was actually upstairs where we saw the body, and as you went in, you saw the blood on the tile and the sink, and then you saw the big ovoid sort of pattern there on the breach between the hallway and the master bedroom. So that's sort of what that's where we spent the majority of the time. And as we walked downstairs, he said, but, you know, there's this camera that's in the washing machine. It's been run through the cycle, so, you know, I'm not really hopeful that anything will come from it, but I want to just take a look at it, see where it is and how it sits. And he opened the lid, and we looked inside, and there was his camera, and it was sort of nestled among a towel and I think another article of clothing. At that point, given what I know, it didn't seem to me that they were going to be able to extract anything from that camera or any photographs or anything that was of noteworthy. But I remember thinking, well, why would somebody put a camera in the washing machine? It just seemed out of place, and I could understand why he wanted me to see what was there. But at that point, I can't speak for him, but I thought to myself, well, I'm not sure that we're going to be able to get anything from this. Probably not, but it just sure does raise a red flag.
Sure. Now, Detective Flores, as well, we cut to the chase. I mean, obviously, Jody Arias' name comes up almost immediately in terms of a person of interest. On her behalf, what does she do with her interaction with Detective Flores? Who contacts who?
Well, that's another aspect of the case. Just like the washing machine, just like the camera in the washing machine. That's another thing that just didn't seem to make sense. But what happened was that same day, while the detective was at the crime scene, Jody Arias called twice, not once but twice, asking to speak to somebody about the case. And a lot of the times, you get ex-girlfriends and people that are feel close to the victim that call in. So when he told me about it, I was at the crime scene, and her name came up as someone who was somewhat of a stalker, kind of clingy kind of girlfriend. When her name came up, we just kind of looked at each other, and he said, well, I'm going to call her back. I'm going to record it, but I'm not sure that anything is going to come from it, but, you know, I'll just call her. Maybe she knows something. But at that point, we really didn't think that it was going to lead to anything for a number of reasons. Number one, Mr. Alexander was a pretty big guy, and it seemed that a woman would have a difficult time overpowering him. And if someone had done this, you wouldn't expect them to be calling the police. So we kind of agreed that that was a follow-up that we had to make sure was completed. And but again, she made the call, and in fact, on June 10th of 2008, he actually got her on the phone, and they discussed a number of things, and he recorded it, and that actually turned out something to be very important because that was something I was able to use later, where she indicated that during that conversation that Mr. Alexander did not have a gun in his house, and if he was going to defend himself, he would only use his fists.
Well, to let the audience know that, and again, there's so many people that have followed this to the letter, but there was a .25 caliber casing that was found.
Right,
in the
that was the
bathroom.
Other thing. Right, it was found just in front of the sink, the vanity area, where there was a large amount of blood, and it actually had landed on blood. So it was clear that there had already been blood on the tile, and the casing fell there. That was part of the, but the detective did not bring up the fact that there was a gun involved, did not bring up the caliber. When he had that conversation with Jody Arias on June 10th, all he asked was, how's it going, that sort of thing, and just let her speak. And she's the one that brought up the thing about the gun, and then the detective asked her, well, does he have a gun, that sort of thing. And that's when Arias said, no, he doesn't have any gun. If he was going to defend himself, he would use his fist. So I think it was pretty astute of him to not even indicate that there had been a gun involved, and she's the one that actually started talking about it.
Mm-hmm. Now, of course, all these modern trials of the last few years are going to include all available evidence, and a lot of really fantastic evidence is, of course, text messages and emails and cell phone location reports. So what does Jody Arias do based on the police being able to gather Travis Alexander's digital correspondence? What does she do in the next few days?
Well, one of the things that police were able to pick up, which was actually, again, it was something that when you look back, you wonder why she would do it, but she killed him on June 4th, sometime around after 5:30 in the evening. And after that, she drove on the freeway up to Utah, which she claimed was her ultimate destination. But sometime around midnight, she called his home or his cell phone and left a message saying, you know, I'm sorry that I didn't get a chance to stop there. I know that you're going to be coming up to visit me up here in Northern California. We can go into Oregon. So she leaves a message clearly indicating that she's never been there, sort of to throw, I guess, the police off her trail. Not content with that, she also sends Mr. Alexander a text message asking him if he received a check that she had sent him. She had actually bought a car from him and was making payments. And so she sent him a text, knowing that he was dead, for asking him whether or not he had received it. And the last thing that she did is she sent him an email, again, indicating that she's sorry that she couldn't show up. So she tried to cover her tracks using the what was available out there electronically. And that actually is something, again, when you take a look at it, it just goes into the planning, the lack of confusion that was associated with this. And so, in a sense, rather than help her out, those are some of the things that actually made it seem that she had planned this a little bit more than she wanted to admit and was not in this fog or did not have any memory issues like she claimed.
Now, what is the progress with the digital, with the camera? What, and when do you find out with, again, give us a sort of a timeline of when do you find out that they're, the results of what they can and can't do with that camera?
Well, they actually were able to get the memory card, memory stick, whatever term you want to use, and what they were able to do is apply a forensic tool to the camera to see if they could bring up any photographs, and not just content with going to look at the photographs that were there, they actually went further into the memory card, into something called unallocated space, which is where everything goes that gets deleted. So they went looking for any items that were deleted, and what the police were able to find were three sets of photographs. The first set, which was on June 4th of 2008, was sometime around 1:30, and it shows the couple, the two of them, engaged in a in some sort of sexual escapade, let's say. And that was part of what drew the media's attention to the case, because there were some salacious photographs of him and her enjoying themselves in a carnal sort of way. Then after that, there was another set of photographs, the ones of Mr. Alexander posing in the shower. Obviously, he doesn't have any clothing on, so it's not like he has a gun on him, a knife, or anything like that, and Jodi Arias is taking those photographs. But what really sets this case apart, and all of those were deleted, those photographs that I've talked about, all those were deleted, but what makes this case even probably more interesting or unique than all the other cases is that there's what I'm labeling is that third set of photographs. And these were taken immediately within 45 seconds, or approximately 45 seconds, after the ones in the shower. And in it, the first photograph that you get is a photograph that is inadvertent or accidental of the lights above the shower. Clearly, that's about the time that the attack either has started or is taking place. And then a couple minutes or so later, you actually see Jodi Arias' foot in front of Travis Alexander's head as she goes to lift his right hand, and you can see he's already bleeding from the throat, so she's already sliced his throat. And what makes this remarkable is that this was an inadvertent photograph. It is clear that what happened is she probably dropped the camera or stepped on the camera, but more likely than not, she dropped the camera, causing it to strike the button to take the photograph, which showed her foot. Then subsequently, as she's dragging the body back, there's another inadvertent photograph, so there's a total of three, that shows her actually dragging him down. This last one shows the baseboards as she's going along towards the sink where she shot him in the head. So what really makes this case unique is those three inadvertent photographs. It's something that I've never seen before. It's something that I don't think most people will ever see, that in the middle of a killing, inadvertent photographs are being taken as the events unfold.
Now, we talk about the July 9th, you present your case to the Maricopa County Grand Jury, and you talk about a true bill. I hadn't really heard that term before, the true bill, so maybe you can explain if that's a unique term. I had not heard of that true bill before. And tell us about Detective Flores is really incredible, the access, obviously, you have, and so you relate the story, and it's very vivid about the confrontation with Jody Arias about this kind of evidence and her reaction. So tell us when that happens in relation to this July 9th grand jury that you present to them. And so tell us about those two things so that we know the timeline of when those two things occurred.
What the law permits is a presentation to a grand jury. And at that time, the grand jurors are asked to make a decision as to whether or not they believe the person that's the suspect and the person who is alleged to have committed certain acts, including the murder, whether or not that person is the person that did that and what they did, whether or not it constituted, in this case, premeditated murder. The jurors are allowed to deliberate after the presentation of the evidence. I was the person who questioned Detective Flores, and their deliberations are in secret. And after that, they make a decision whether or not the case will go forward. And they take a vote, and that vote signifies if it's something that the case is going to go forward, then they issue what is called a true bill. A true bill is nothing more an indication that they have agreed that a charge is appropriate, and in this case, the charge that they indicated was appropriate was premeditated first-degree murder. Within the week, Detective Flores went to Yreka, California, because that's where Jody Arias was living. And he went there not to say hello, not to do anything like that. He went to arrest her. He already at that point had an arrest warrant. And when he went there, he was able to find her. They were able to take her into custody. And after taking her into custody on the 15th of July, he began to question her. And initially, her story was that, well, I wasn't at the at Travis Alexander's house. I wasn't there on the date that he was killed, so it really wasn't me, even though the detective already had the photograph showing that that wasn't true. After that initial day of conversations, the next day there was more discussions, and at that point, Jody Arias changed her story and said, you know, got to tell you, what I told you yesterday was not the truth. And what actually happened was that while I was taking those photographs in the shower, of him in the shower, two individuals showed up, a man and a woman. And according to them, what they were there was to kill Travis Alexander, and she even went so far as to say that the gun was put to her head and that she was lucky to have escaped with a warning that if she ever said anything, well, they were going to do damage or harm to her family, and that's why she hadn't said anything. So she had quite the story, but it was all recorded, so she couldn't go back and say, well, no, I didn't say what the police are claiming that I said. So she initially gave two stories. One, she wasn't there. She changed that and then said that it was actually two other people that had killed Mr. Alexander.
And she repeated this same fanciful tale to media, 48 Hours and Inside Edition as well.
She did. She was adamant, and that's what had happened. And so she spoke to the news magazine 48 Hours on two separate occasions for more than a couple of hours each time, or approximately a couple of hours each time. And every time she repeated that no, she had nothing to do with this. She was actually the innocent bystander that it just happened to be there when these two horrible people came in and did all of this to Travis. She couldn't explain why they let her go and why they would allow her to leave if she had seen what had happened. And she couldn't explain why she didn't call the police. One would think that if you had seen your ex-boyfriend murdered, somebody that you'd been intimate with, that you would have at least called the police once they let you go. But, of course, she didn't do that. So not only did she continue with that story, but what that showed me is that she was someone who relished being in the limelight, somebody who relished being the center of attention. And so that told me that that later on she would, throughout these proceedings, maybe that's a role that she would partake of, that she would always want to be the center of attention, specifically take the witness stand. I took that to mean that she probably was going to take the witness stand, and ultimately that turned out to be the case.
Yes, because she'd have to take, if she was trying any kind of self-defense or anything, where she would have to testify to those. She could not go on a stand and try to relate those facts, could she?
Right, because under the evidentiary rules, her statements or any story that she gave, she would have to give, because nobody else could give it for her, because that would be hearsay. I mean, that's the legal basis for it. But so she needed to go up there and explain to them what happened. I mean, the strength of that is, for her, the reason that's beneficial for her is that Mr. Alexander, unfortunately, the other person that was there, could not contradict what she was saying, because he was dead. She'd removed the only other witness that was present. So in a certain way, I knew that she was going to take the witness stand, and she, of course, she knew that Mr. Alexander wouldn't be there to contradict it. So in a sense, that's a pretty good tactic.
Now, the police, you talked about premeditation, and we won't get into, we won't talk about the fine definition of that, but suffice to say that if you're trying to build a premeditated first-degree murder charge, there has to be some evidence of planning, and that's what you're trying to ultimately build, is a first-degree murder conviction for this person. So on two evidentiary fronts, we'll say, the rent-a-car, and so there was a rent-a-car. So you can tell us about that, but also after that we can talk about what was found at the house. The car was parked in front of her parents' place to rent a car. Then there was an investigation from there, but it was also what you found in the home, and we're talking about the infamous shoebox with receipts.
Right.
So first tell us about how police proceed with the rented car.
Well, the police determined that, or were able to find that for her trip on June 4th, Arias had actually rented a car, and she rented it from Budget. And what she did is, rather than rent the car, and there were two car rental agencies in Wairika where she lived, rather than rent the car in Wairika, what she did is she drove 90 miles south to a place called Redding, California, to the airport. It is clear that she did that so that she would run less of a risk of being recognized, because Wairika back then had a population of approximately 7,000 people. So it was a very small town, and if she was renting a car, chances are somebody would know that it was her that was renting the car, and so it would increase the chances of her getting caught. So she rented the car in Redding, and when asked about the car, and she was given a red car, she told the person renting it, "Well, you know, I really don't want the red car, and the reason I don't want the red car is because that calls attention, and the police may notice it more. I want a white car." And she was actually took the white car so that it would be less noticeable to the police. Of course, we did have those receipts, and the police did find them in this infamous shoebox that they found during the execution of the warrant at the place that she lived in Wairika. But what they didn't find was any receipts for gasoline here in the state of Arizona. They only found a number of receipts there for purchases or buys that she made in California, specifically Pasadena. And then there were other receipts for items that she bought, for example, on her trip back from Utah. So there was this big, gaping, empty hole where there were no receipts for that time. What I was able to find was that there was one receipt from Salinas, California. I was at that point already alerted, or had already learned, that she had tried or had actually called an ex-boyfriend to borrow 2 5-gallon gas cans for her trip. And I'm sort of fond of saying, or because I remember thinking, well, why would she ask, why would she need gas cans, especially 2 5-gallon ones, to travel on the road there. I know, and I don't live in California, but I'm positive that they have gas stations there. So immediately that was kind of a bit of a red flag for me. But then as I looked at the receipts, there was one from Salinas, California, a Walmart, and in it it had the notation, the last item, something about a Carocarb, K-E-R-O-C-A-R-B. When I called Walmart, they told me that, well, that's actually another, that's a 5-gallon gas can. So then she has the amount, or she has 15 extra gallons of gas can, and if you multiply that out, let's say 30 miles a gallon, it was probably a little more, that gives her a range of 450 extra miles. And if you add, if you multiply that by, or add that to the mileage that she already got for the tank of gas, which was approximately 12.5 gallons, you could see that she could make the trip from California, from the border of California, all the way through Arizona, and make her way all the way up to Utah without having to stop for gas, because if you add that up, you're looking at approximately maybe 800 miles that she could go. That was her range. And there's approximately 400 miles from California to Mesa, and then another 300 from Mesa to Las Vegas. So you're looking at 700. So it's a trip that she not only could make, she actually did make with the aid of those 3 5-gallon gas cans.
Now, it's very important, this discovery, and we just skimmed over the very, very interesting way you did discover this, is because in your unrelenting sort of review of the information, and also, you got to say, a little bit of luck, because she has different lawyers, and those first lawyers prepare some documents, and again, you're sort of fanatical in detail, so you're going over things and racking your brain very much. This sounds very, very much movie-esque in this part of the book, where you're looking and this is the thing that stumps you. This is the big breakthrough, is these gas cans. And of course, even when you see that information, that Daryl Brewer said that Jody Arias had called a couple months before and said, "I'd like to borrow these gas cans," that it wasn't evident to you at first, but you got to say that you were fortunate that you even had that information in the first place, weren't you?
Absolutely, and I think that I will never turn my back on luck, because I think that sometimes, well, a lot of the times is what assists you in the case. But in order to take advantage of that luck, you have to be prepared to do so. And I think that, as I said, yes, I do believe that I was a bit lucky that because the line involving the gas cans and the ex-boyfriend Daryl Brewer was just buried in all these documents, and there was hundreds of pages, maybe thousands, I don't remember the count right now, but buried in there was 2 or 3, maybe 4 or 5 lines setting that out, and it was sort of like a throwaway kind of part of the conversation. Because Mr. Brewer was being asked about her character and what kind of person she was, what her relationship was with his child. And so when that interview, for whatever reason, he said, "Well, I received a call from her in late May asking to borrow 2 gas cans for a trip to Mesa, Arizona," that immediately told me that this wasn't a trip where she was impulsive after speaking to Travis and decided to just on the spur of the moment go to Arizona. That told me that it was planned, and it also told me that she planned to kill him before she left Wairika, because nobody would undertake such elaborate preparation. But I will admit having those items turned over to me by the defense certainly provided one of the keys to the prosecution, probably the primary key. I would not have thought to ask Daryl Brewer, "Hey, did she call you to borrow some gas cans?" I just wouldn't have thought of that. So yes, luckily for me, that was there, and luckily for me, I was able to take advantage of it.
The other part, I think it's fortunate too, is the character of these perpetrators. If she would have been if she wouldn't have been, I guess, so arrogant and confident, that she might have done what most people would do, is get a good lawyer and keep her mouth shut, and that would have made a huge difference in this case. But despite that didn't happen. But what I found was the most fascinating of this book is the the cunning and the clever tactic that Detective Flores did in this as well, because you got to see his interviews and you went over those interviews and those telephone, every bit of information that he had gotten, you were reviewing it, which, so even though you weren't working together, there was a sort of a tandem cooperation between you in terms of you definitely benefited from the information, like him pushing her to tell the circuitous route that she tried to claim that she did, and showed it to be, basically in an impossible, incredulous route. But you also at that time were learning, in preparation for trial, as you say, what you were going to be facing at trial in the character of Judy Arias, weren't you?
Sure. I had taken note during the interview with the interviews with Detective Flores that she was very skilled at her use of the English language, in the sense that she was able to craft stories, for lack of a better term, that almost seemed believable. The way I try to describe it, or the way it seems to me, is that we all know that the sun rises in the east, and so if not that this happened, but if I'm sure that if I would have asked her, isn't it true that the sun rises in the east, she would have looked at me and said, well, I'm not too sure, because I have a room that has a west-facing window, and every morning when I wake up, there's sunshine coming in, so I'm not really sure if it rises in the east. So, I mean, that showed me that this was the type of person that was very skilled at sort of turning what is an obvious truth and then maybe spinning it, and then conversely taking what is not true and making it seem like the truth. So I knew that going in, and of course, I was able to see that when she spoke to Detective Flores. So when it came down to it, at the end there, I knew that this was somebody that I could not take lightly. This was somebody that I needed to perhaps be a bit firm with her, because if I wasn't, she would just tell her story the way that she wanted. And so, in fact, that's why I adopted the strategy that I did, to be, like I said, extremely stern with her on the witness stand and asking her questions like, isn't it true? Whatever the question was. Sometimes I would even say, is that a yes or a no? Because she wouldn't answer questions directly.
Right. Now, you say normally that within 2 years they're ready for trial, but this took 4 years. And in that time, of course, there's still the ongoing investigation. You are talking to people like Daryl Brewer. You're talking to everybody you possibly can to get a sense of what her character is and what she might be prepared to do at trial. And also, there is a development in that she changes lawyers, and that's like we talked about how you got the document about Daryl Brewer. What is the reason for the change in lawyers? And as a result of the change in lawyers, what are you notified about, and what do you see is coming down the pike?
Well, she did. There were lawyers that assumed the case after the first set of lawyers. I'm not privy to the reasons why she may have changed lawyers, or why other lawyers were substituted in. So I really can't speak to that. The only thing that I can say is that the first set of lawyers disclosed a number of documents, or provided a number of documents to me. The second set of lawyers took a little bit of a different tact. And by a different tact, I mean they changed the plea. In other words, they indicated that they had a different defense than the previous set. And they indicated that it was their view that they intended to present evidence to show that this was a case of self-defense. What that meant to me immediately was that the two stories before that she had said before were not true. The one about her not being there, and the other one about the two individuals, the man and the woman, being there. What she was now saying was that that what she did, the killing, the stabbing, the slicing of the throat, and the shooting of the head, that was all justified, and that's the term that's used. And the reason it was justified, according to her, was that there was a history here, and there was a history of physical and verbal abuse along with sexual abuse. And then just to sort of round out this idea that under the circumstances she was justified in killing him, or that it was the right thing for her to do legally. And I mean, it's like you can say that the defense can be, even if you cut it down to the bone, you can say, well, the person had it coming to him. They had it coming to him because of what they were doing at the time. And in her case, what he was doing at the time was that he was attacking her, and based on everything that had happened in the past, well, her belief that he was attacking her and might kill her was reasonable. That's what she was saying. So he sort of had it coming to him, and not only did he sort of have it coming to him, he was an individual who was a pedophile. So with all of that, then we sort of, I had to step back, take a look at everything else, and see what there was to contradict what she was saying. One of the things that I had to keep in mind back then was that the investigation had been geared to identifying the person who had done all of this. When she said, oh, no, I wasn't there, or it was somebody else, the police were still in the process of identifying who did this. Well, once she said this was in self-defense, all of their investigations sort of went out the window, because now it's just a new issue. The issue is, yes, she was there, but was she justified in doing the stabbing, the slicing, and the shooting? And that's when I, of course, if you will, had to sort of turn the focus of the investigation and look at other things so that I could deal with it at trial.
Now, it's fascinating to talk about how attorneys, their attorneys, and also you in the prosecution's office take advantage legally of certain things. And so tell our audience what you hold back in terms of, you explained that if you were to ask Detective Flores about something, he would have to write up a report of that conversation between you two. So there is a little bit of a play here in terms of, did you hold back something from Detective Flores that you can use at trial because you do not want to share with the defense? So tell us what that key issue is that is held back.
Well, police officers, whenever they touch a case or when they do something, they generally, and I would say most of the time, if it's a minor thing, perhaps not, but they write a report. And in this case, if I had, for example, asked Detective Flores to check on the receipt from Walmart and he started making the calls, then he would have had to write a report that said, oh, I was calling around and I spoke to somebody at Walmart and they told me that this item was actually a gas can. So rather than do that, I was the one that actually did the calling, and I was the one that took a look at all this stuff. And I withheld that information from him. I part of it was that if I'm out there talking about it, who knows what may be said later on down the line by people. So that information was with me totally, and I made the decision not to let him know. And I remember when I asked her about the gas cans, and or I asked Daryl Brewer about the gas cans because he took the stand before her. When I sat down, he kind of looked at me and he said, what the heck? What was that all about? I didn't know that about these gas cans. And I told him, no, of course you didn't. And the reason was that they had given me the information so I could in turn use it. And so I didn't have an obligation to let them know what I was thinking. And so I did not tip my hand to the information that I was using. So it's not that it was any games that were being played or anything. It was just my strategy with regard to the case. I remember that even in opening statement, they were maintaining that her trip to Mesa was spur of the moment. When I heard that, I knew that couldn't be true. That couldn't be the case, because there were these three gas cans that indicated that she had actually planned it. And again, I waited till the very end to ask her about the third gas can, and I remember asking her, well, what is it this, you know, you claim that you took the third gas can back to Walmart, and why is it that you were using it to fill up with, that you filled it up with gas in Salt Lake City? I vividly remember that at first she didn't have an answer, but she responded as she did, as she always used to seem to do, and she responded and said, well, I was never in Salt Lake City. So, of course, I could prove that she was there because of all the receipts. But I mean, that was the strategy involved with the gas cans. And so if a jury sees that, hopefully they are swayed that this person is not somebody that is credible.
Now, just before the trial, just to, and again, this is a something that I guess people that might have followed the trial and did not read your book would not know, but we talk about, you talk about the Bob White letters that were deemed inadmissible, but not for lack of trying. So tell us about this fascinating part before we, again, just talk about the trial. So talk about the Bob White letters, where they came from, and how they were investigated away.
At around the time that, or immediately before, the defendant indicated that she was changing her defense to self-defense, it appears that some copies of some letters ostensibly or putatively or allegedly written by Travis Alexander were emailed to defense counsel, and they in turn noticed them to me or provided me the email, these letters. And these letters, of course, were ostensibly written by Mr. Alexander. After looking at the letters and a number of things in those letters, I came to the conclusion, obviously I'm not an expert, but just based on what I knew about the case and based on what I had seen, that they were actually not written by Mr. Alexander. And so one of the things that I did is that I actually made a request of the court, and it's called a motion, that these letters be excluded because they were forged or fraudulent. And one of the things that I did to try to advance my position was to go to the jail to see if there were any writings from Jody Arias so that I could see what her writing was like. And some of the items that had been confiscated from her was a 3x5 card that had some writing on it. And that writing was almost exactly like the writing that was in the letter. So immediately it seemed to sort of have the bell ring in my head saying something's not right here. I then obtained original letters written by Mr. Alexander, and I had a handwriting analysis done. And the person who did the handwriting analysis, his opinion, he's a documents examiner. His name's Alan Kreidel. He's with the Arizona Department of Public Safety. But his opinion was that more likely than not, those letters were forged. And not only were those letters forged, the 3x5 card that I had obtained, that had been seized or taken from Jody Arias, whoever had written that 3x5 card was actually trying to emulate or simulate Mr. Alexander's writing, and that was the person who probably wrote the letter. So I was able to show through this, what we call circumstantial evidence, but really the circumstances, that she had actually probably was the person that they were forged, and that she was probably the person who forged them. Adding to this, while I was, again, at the jail standing there at one time, and I noticed that there was she had a visitor, and she attempted to give a couple of magazines to this visitor. And in those magazines, the people at the jail were able to find that she had written messages on various pages, sort of encrypted. And the message was, and I don't know who these messages were too, but they were right before the hearing involving the letters, and it saying something, you messed up, and obviously it was a much harsher word for messed up, and you messed up when you spoke to my lawyers, something like that. You need to come in and see me so that we can get your story so that it corroborates what I've been saying for the last year or so. So, given all of that, what ended up happening is that that was presented, the letters were withdrawn, and they never saw the light of day.
Now, just before we get to the trial, and again, this is a trial that captivated America and the world, basically. There was so much attention to this. Something resonated in people, and they were following this very much, maybe not quite like the O.J. Simpson case, but there hasn't been a case since O.J. that's seemed to attract this much attention, this one person involved. Now, you cite a case of, and because the death penalty is important, and we won't get into any kind of debate even remotely, but you do talk about Joseph Andriano, and you cite this example of how you justify pursuing this death penalty case, because you use the example of Joseph Andriano And then the provisions that there must be an infliction of physical or mental anguish. She should know or should have known that he would have suffered. So tell us why Jody Arias qualifies as compared to Joseph Andreano. Tell us why you compared them and how you justify that Jody Arias deserves the death penalty that you pursued.
Well, both of the cases that you just cited, the Arias case and the Wendy Andreano case, and I'll talk about that one first. In that case, the killing was especially cruel, and what that factor speaks to is the physical and emotional suffering of the person who's being killed prior to death, so they have to be conscious. In the Wendy Andreano case, part of the reason I pointed it out is because it involved a woman, and there was also a sense of overkill with that one. He was dying of cancer and was already going to die, but that wasn't enough for her, so she went on the internet and under the name of Ann Newton purchased some chemical that is used in propellant for airbags, sodium azide, and gave it to him. And, of course, he didn't die quick enough. He was vomiting, but he didn't die quick enough. So what she did, actually, after that, is that she beat him over the head, and he would have died from that. And then after that, she slit his throat. So I cited it because it had some of the same elements, and she was the first person sentenced to death by a jury. I didn't do it to say that the jury was wrong or anything like that. I just to show that right. that cases that, and I do not make the decision as to whether or not a case, the death penalty is going to be sought. That is made by the county attorney. That is the political person. And so I had nothing to do with that. And that was his decision and his decision solely. And so, of course, not every case that goes to trial, there's a conviction. And so just because the state believes that the death penalty is appropriate, that's not how it works. And in this case, the jury decided, at least on the second phase, that by a vote of 11-1 in favor of the death penalty, it has to be unanimous here in Arizona, that would not be the case because it was not a unanimous verdict. And for me, I mean, I accept what the jury has to say. I understand that's how the system works. And I don't even really, after the verdict comes in, I do not waste my time worrying about why they did it, why they didn't do it. I don't speak to the jurors and say, well, what caused you not to vote for it? What caused you to vote for it? That's their decision. And, you know, I believe that their deliberations are sacred and they should be protected. So in this particular case, once the decision was made that it was going to be, in a sense, a hung jury, and that that would mean the imposition of life, I just moved on.
Now, we talk about your preparation. You talk about in the book the incredible preparation you had for this, and when her defense changed her strategy. Again, a lot of the information that they gained through the investigation was really not so useful because they had to counter what her defense was saying and the strategy that they were using to try to defend her from these charges. So you had this 4 years to prepare. You reviewed those interviews. You listened to the phone calls. You knew Jody Arias as well as anybody possibly could. What was your strategy in terms of how you would, we touched on it, but how you would try to get, rattle her on the stand? She was the star witness, so she was the most important witness. What was your strategy and what was your approach before you went into that trial?
I knew that she needed to take the witness stand in order for her claim to be seriously considered by the jury. So going in, having reviewed all the items that you've mentioned, I knew that a typical approach where I would stand there with a legal pad in hand, pen in the left hand, and maybe a pen on the right, and having all these questions written down would not be productive. It just wouldn't, because that's not the type of conversation that would be conducive to anything other than having her repeat what she had said before, because it would be a bit too slow. The other thing was that I already knew that unless she was pushed, she would keep to that position. And so I decided to be strident. I decided that I'm not going to use notes, and I didn't use notes when I was questioning her. And I was going to, at every turn, have something showing or proving up what I was asking. So, for example, when I started out asking about, I remember the first day asking about what I wanted to really go into was that she claimed that Mr. Alexander had damaged her left pinky when he had physically abused her. I had a photograph, and she gave a date. I had a photograph subsequent to that that showed her pinky was straight, and that the only way that it could happen was when she attacked him. So I didn't just go chronologically and say, look, let's start with day one, then go to day two and day three. If I'd have done that again, she would have been able to follow it and would have been very prepared. I decided to jump around from subject to subject so that she wouldn't have as much time to prepare or think of the answers. And I remember starting the first day by asking her, because there was a telephone call that she had recorded surreptitiously, and in it where she and Mr. Alexander were heard involved in some sort of masturbatory activity. And in that phone, after sort of the embers have are cooling off, she says something about her dumb sister. And I remember thinking, well, I want to ask her about that. Not because I just want to embarrass her or anything like that, but because she chided Mr. Alexander for being critical of her family, and yet she could do it. So it was a way for me to show there was a double standard, and then segue into the thing involving the left little finger. So started out asking her by that. She didn't expect that. And if I asked her in an unexpected fashion, one of the things that she even did, she admitted, well, yeah, I think my sister's stupid, and my sister's dumb, but then she also added that she was stupid. So the approach was to sort of not be linear in my questioning and to be strident. And if that called for me to say yes or no, I want to know what the answer to this question is, well, then so be it. And I mean, she was even much. She was up to the challenge. For example, if she had a question that she didn't know the answer to, she would ask me to repeat it, or she would say that she didn't remember, or that she had memory problems. And then if I used the word problems, she wanted to use the word issue. So, and then she even resorted to saying, "Well, you're just like Mr. Alexander. You're trying to scramble my brain because you're raising your voice." So, I mean, she was very adept. I don't know. I'm not going to say prepared, but I'm just going to say that she was very adept when she was on the witness stand, and that my way of dealing with it was to be very assertive with her.
Now, we didn't touch on this, but an important part of this trial is this. Again, you talk about the salacious nature, and what I didn't know of is that Mesa has a big community, a strong community of Mormons, and the Latter-day Saints and the Mormon religion are important in this, in terms of, I guess, the community that's in Mesa, but also the tactic that Jodi Arias used and her defense to try to, of course, they're going to have to try to make Travis Alexander seem like a violent person. So tell us, again, not to dwell on it, but how important this salacious nature and the sex and the forbidden religion kind of thing played in this.
Well, it's true that Mr. Alexander was LDS or Mormon, but one of the things that I attempted to show was that, and that shouldn't get lost in this, was that Jodi Arias was also LDS. So any of these sins, as she wanted to portray him as somebody who was a sinner, applied to her as well. Because if he was involved in this, well, so was she. So that's the first point to be made here. There was a prohibition, or there is a prohibition, pretty strong prohibition, that in the LDS faith, that says that premarital sex is to be strongly discouraged. You just shouldn't do it. And so in her bringing that up, pointing it out, not only was she saying, is he sexually abusive to me, but he's somebody that should be looked down upon, because look at the type of character that he has. Not only he presents himself a certain way during most of the time when he goes to church, that sort of thing, as somebody who is a very good Mormon, but then he turns around and does these things. What she forgot, of course, was that she was doing the same thing, and she's supposed to be a good Mormon girl. Additionally, just because somebody engages in sexual activity, whether they are LDS or not, does not mean that they should pay for the sins, because those were sort of what they are. They should pay for the sins by having the Grim Reaper in the form of Jodi Arias strike him down by stabbing him in the heart, then, you know, slicing his throat and then shooting him. That's not the way the church sees it. And maybe she tried to portray him as an individual that perhaps, again, was a sinner and somebody who deserved, I guess, a little bit of punishment, and maybe try to confuse the issues. So that's how she tried to use the religion, I thought.
You've probably been asked this many times, and it's not a rhetorical question, but it might be an unanswerable question in terms of conclusions. Why do you think that this case captivated the American audience, the American America so much? I mean, part of it, I believe, was your, you know, vigorous approach to questioning her. I don't think everybody has seen that, has experienced that. But still, to get that kind of attention from the public and from the media, there must have been something to her character, not just your character, attacking her. What was it about Jodi Arias that captivated America?
Well, in speaking to people, and I've received letters and calls, that sort of thing, it seems that the general feeling is that this is one of the cases where justice, or good, if you will, triumphs over evil. If you mentioned this earlier, there's this case of O.J. Simpson. The majority of people believe that he's guilty, but he was acquitted. We also have the Zimmerman case out in Florida, and some people there believe that he's also guilty, and he was acquitted. And you know, there's a poster child involving alleged child abuse, and she was not convicted either, Casey Anthony. So what made this case, I think, different, and I think what captured the, as you say, the attention and maybe the imagination of people in this country and perhaps internationally, is that in this case there was somebody who was standing up for justice. I was standing up in a sense, in a way that I was not shy about it, and I guess in a way it made these people feel good. I know that I received calls from people who said that for example, a situation where their mother was suffering from terminal cancer. And one of the things that when she was feeling the worst, and maybe the medication wasn't doing the best that it could, one of the ways that this woman who was suffering from cancer, one of the ways that she would feel better is to watch this trial, because it was able to sort of draw her in and make her forget. And it drew her in because it was a struggle between this right versus wrong, and right seemed to be winning. And so I think that's part of it. And then the other part, of course, was the salaciousness of it. I mean, we heard in very intimate, minute detail everything you could possibly hear about two individuals who were involved in a sexual activities. I mean, it was a sexual a clinic. Worthy of Masters and Johnson.
Yes. In your estimation, and of course you detail it in the book, so it's not just a little, determination like I'm asking, because it's more complicated than that, but to dumb it down a little bit, what did you feel was the most crucial point in the cross-examination of Jodi Arias that was a breakthrough?
When I was able to show that she was somebody who was not credible, someone who would not stop and would be able to misrepresent things to the jury, And when I was able to show that she had that third gas can, even though she had claimed she had returned it to Walmart, according to her, Walmart didn't give her any receipts because, you know, the rules didn't apply to Jody Arias at Walmart, apparently. And she had returned it for a refund. I was able to show that what she was saying wasn't absolutely untrue. No one could doubt that she had actually had that third gas can, never returned it to Walmart. And at that point, pretty much anything that she said was doubt cast on just about everything that she said. So when she then claimed, or everything that she had claimed about Mr. Alexander, well then, about whether or not he attacked her, that was also called into doubt. And I think that was the point that probably the jury seized on. Again, I didn't speak to them, but it seemed to me that the way I saw it, that at that point, everyone knew, without a shadow of a doubt, that Jody Arias could not be trusted.
Now, not everybody, after prosecuting a case, especially if they're not retired, and you explain this, and I guess I'll get you to explain this, why did you feel it was important to write the book? And most people wait till they're retired. So tell us why you didn't wait till you're retired, and why did you feel it was important to write this book?
Every case, I guess, that you do or you see, there's some value or some teaching value to it. I believe that in seeing what I see out in the media and other things, that everybody watches TV, and I know everybody realizes that it's condensed and all that, but it was just a way to sort of, educate the public a little bit about what actually happens in the trial, what actually goes into it, because that's what makes it interesting, and so that they can know what is going on, and the idea that it's open to the public is also, I think, is also a good idea. So those things were part of the reason that I wrote the book. I do think it's educational. We talk about direct examination, cross-examination, and redirect, and, you know, how juries can ask questions in Arizona, that sort of thing, and what the rules allow and don't allow. So there's that component, and I just thought that my thoughts were a good story, and in this fight for justice, they could see what was going on, what exactly it was that I used to arm myself to bring this case to a conclusion, to a conviction, and that's why I chose the title. The reason I didn't retire is that I'm not ready. There's nothing that says that I can't write about something that has happened. I don't handle the case anymore. That's with the Office of the Attorney General. I don't have anything to do with the case, so there didn't seem to me to be any reason to wait. Why wait 5-10 years after retire? I may never retire. I may live another 20 years and work there. So there really isn't anything magical about it. I followed the rules. I obtained permission before I wrote it. I made sure that I abided by the rules. And so it just seemed that it was the right time to do it. And as far as retiring, well, again, as I said, I don't see that as a sort of a line or that would indicate that a book should or shouldn't be written. I know that other prosecutors have retired and done it, but maybe I'm a little different that way. I just don't want to leave the job.
Well, that's great. Absolutely. Now, before I let you go, I wanted to ask this question: what has been the reaction? I know the public has been mad over this book. You have rave reviews. I'm sure the sales have been incredible. And the interest in this... you can find out so much information, so many videos online. But what has been the reaction from your colleagues, which is probably most important to you?
I have to admit that, it's not something that I like to discuss with people that I work with. So I don't – it's not something that's a topic of conversation. At work, when I'm at work, I'm there to deal with the cases that are there, and so I can't say what the reaction is of people that I work with because I don't discuss it. That's something that's separate and apart, and I really do not bring it into work with me, if you will, the idea that I wrote a book. But obviously, I do know that that people in my office know that I wrote it. And, I mean, I've heard comments, perhaps in the elevator or something like that, where people have said that they've enjoyed it. So beyond that, there really isn't too much discussion about it with my colleagues.
Yeah, it's very interesting how you basically have stated, I mean, you state in the book as well, just this is 7 years of your life from the beginning to the end, and you have an ability to put that away and continue with your life, your private life, and this is just another chapter, and you are continuing with the work that you enjoy and that you love and serve the community that you are a big part of and want to be
right.
in. So.
And you know, the case was like a relationship. It was not a good relationship. It was a bad relationship. But like all relationships, you know, you're happy when they're done because they are a bad relationship, but you miss it. And of course, I think about it, and I think about it, but it's done, and I've moved on.
Yeah, I've got to commend you on this book. It's a brilliant book, and especially interesting for people like myself, and I think our audience, the savvy audience I have too, will find the unique aspects of this book. Coming from a prosecutor in this incredibly high-profile case and every single detail, and again, fantastically written, on your edge of your seat, even though you know the outcome of the case, you can't get a better testament. For those that might want to, of course, they know where to buy the book, Amazon, and but also, is there a Facebook page, a fan page? So could you tell us how people might want to communicate or comment or find out more about the community itself that's involved with this book? Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, I know that the book is available at Amazon and at Barnes & Noble. I do know that there are a couple of ways to communicate with me. Of course, HarperCollins, if people contact them, of course, the messages will get to me. And one thing I must say, I don't have Facebook. I'm not really somebody who, I don't know how to say it other than to say that. I just don't have I don't have a computer, so there's no way to communicate with me that way. Obviously, I do have a workplace. If people want to call me there, I mean, I will return their calls probably, but not during work hours because, again, I devote my time to work when I'm there. Then the best way to get a hold of me is through HarperCollins. They're out of New York, and any calls or any messages there are always forwarded to me. Any inquiries by people are always sent to me, and I respond to them all.
Well, that's great. I want to thank you very much, Juan, for coming on, talking about your incredible book, Conviction, The Untold Story of Putting Jody Arias Behind Bars. It's been fascinating, and thank you for taking the time to come and share this incredible story with our audience. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me on. Take care.
You have a great night.
You too.
Good night.